From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and the future of the Affordable Care Act is on the line today. A federal appeals court in New Orleans is hearing arguments on whether a decision by a Texas judge in December to strike down the entire law should stand. The judge agreed with a group of 20 Republican-led states that brought the lawsuit. They argued that the law's individual mandate was unconstitutional after Congress got rid of the tax penalty for not having health insurance back in 2017. This case could affect 20 million Americans who've gotten health coverage since Obamacare was passed nearly a decade ago. Let's bring in Julie Rovner, chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Jeremy.
Okay, so explain what exactly is happening today.
So today, a three-judge panel on the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals is going to look at this decision from December that ruled the entire health care law is unconstitutional because Congress eliminated the tax penalty for not having insurance. The 20 red states argued that without the tax penalty, the law must fall because the tax was what got the Supreme Court to uphold it back in 2012.
So if the tax penalty is reduced to zero, then that decision, they say, doesn't stand anymore.
That's right. And the district court judge in Texas agreed with them last December.
So on the other side of this argument, there's a group of blue states that are trying to preserve the Affordable Care Act. And they say eliminating the fine for not having insurance should not invalidate the entire law. What are they saying?
They're saying that there are so many other pieces of the Affordable Care Act that have absolutely nothing to do with the individual insurance market. And they're correct. There were huge changes to the healthcare system, to the Medicaid program, to the Medicare program for people who have employer-provided insurance, things that really have nothing even to do with health insurance, like allowing for generic biologic drugs, renewing the Indian Health Service. I mean, there were just lots and lots of things in the law that they say have absolutely nothing to do with whether or not the law can stand after they zeroed out the tax penalty.
So what's at stake if the court here rules against the ACA?
Well, obviously, as you mentioned, 20-some million people who are getting their coverage through programs created by the ACA, primarily people who buy their own insurance on the marketplaces and people who have gotten expanded Medicaid in most of the states now. But it also touches, as I just mentioned, everybody who uses the healthcare system. And really, it would make an enormous mess of the healthcare system if the law were just to be suddenly invalidated.
And by the way, if it were invalidated by this court, it would make its way to the Supreme Court, I assume.
Yes, that's what we would assume.
Okay.
We assume no matter what, this is going to end up at the Supreme Court.
Where do insurance companies come down on this?
Well, insurance companies obviously do not want the law to be invalidated. They filed a brief with the court that said that invalidating it would wreak havoc on the healthcare system. And it's not just insurance companies. Hospitals filed briefs. A group of doctor organizations filed briefs. They all use the word chaos or, you know, upend the entire healthcare system. And frankly, in this case, that's not really hyperbole. This would have enormous ramifications on the healthcare system as a whole, because so much has changed about the healthcare system with the ACA, and so many private entities have invested so much money in things that the law did.
Okay, and we said there are 20 Republican-led states that are behind this lawsuit. The Trump administration is on board with those states?
Yes, they are now. The Trump administration has had multiple different positions on this. Last summer, they first said that, well, maybe not the whole law should be invalidated, but the pieces that are closest to that tax penalty, things like requiring insurers to sell to people with pre-existing conditions and to sell to them at the same price. The administration said maybe those things would need to be struck down, but all those other sort of things that don't have to do with the individual market could stay. Then after the district court decision came down in December, the administration said, yeah, we agree with that decision. We think the whole law needs to fall. Then late last week, they filed yet another brief that suggested that possibly the law would only be struck down in the states that sued, which seems kind of odd and implausible, but so we're not exactly sure what the administration is.
But so how would this play out politically? Because we think back to the 2018 midterm election, that was all about health care, and everybody on both sides was saying, well, we support protections for pre-existing conditions, which, as we've talked about, Julie, is part of the Affordable Care Act, those protections for pre-existing conditions. This would be a big part of the conversation in the 2020 presidential race.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was in 2012 when the Affordable Care Act was first at the Supreme Court. Republicans in Congress are terrified of this lawsuit. The last thing they want is for this law to be struck down right in the middle of the campaign. Democrats are scared of it for what it might do, but politically, it would probably, you know, hew to their benefit. Mm-hmm.
And would this be the final say, by the way, when it gets to the Supreme Court?
Oh,
on the ACA, it would be more.
I keep saying after every lawsuit, maybe yeah. Is this the end? And it doesn't ever seem to be.
Well, what else would we talk to you about then, Julie, when we bring you on? Julie Rovner, Chief Washington Correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, now to the case of Jeffrey Epstein. He's been charged with sex trafficking underage girls. Today, President Trump was asked about the man he once called a terrific guy. He socialized with him.
Well, I knew him like everybody in Palm Beach knew him. I mean, people in Palm Beach knew him. He was a fixture in Palm Beach. I had a falling out with him a long time ago. I don't think I've spoken to him for 15 years. I wasn't a fan.
Well, also today, Trump's Labor Secretary, Alex Acosta, tweeted out that the charges against Epstein are horrific, and I am pleased New York prosecutors are moving forward with a case based on new evidence. In 2008, Acosta, as the U.S. attorney in Miami, cut Epstein a light deal after he pled guilty to a lesser charge of prostitution, an agreement that was kept secret from Epstein's alleged victims, something a judge recently ruled illegal. Lots to go over with NPR's Quill Lawrence, who's covering this story. And Quill, critics would say Acosta himself had plenty of evidence in 2008, but cut that light deal. Democrats are calling for Acosta to step down. Both he and the president seem to be on the defense.
Right. I mean, Acosta was tweeting out that based on this new evidence, he's glad they move forward. In the sealed indictment that was opened up yesterday, there really didn't seem to be anything new. They were focusing on this period between 2002 and 2005, the same period of time where the alleged victims had testified. And it does seem to be the same evidence. Now, some new evidence is emerging since they got a warrant to search Epstein's mansion on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, but that hasn't been entered in yet, as far as we know. The indictment was just about those same cases.
Well, today the president also defended his labor secretary, Alex Acosta. Let's listen.
I can only say this from what I know and what I do know is that he's been a great, really great secretary of labor. The rest of it we'll have to look at. We'll have to look at it very carefully. But you're talking about a long time ago. And again, it was a decision made, I think, not by him, but by a lot of people. So we're going to look at it very carefully.
Quill, what about that? This seemed to be a decision made by him, Acosta.
Well, he had to sign off on it, but the president makes a valid point there. A lot of people crafted this deal. Mm-hmm. Not all of them were defense lawyers for Epstein at the time. Everyone had to sign off on it in Florida and at the federal level where Acosta was signing off on it. So as people are calling for Acosta to resign in editorial pages and mostly from the Democratic side of the aisle in Washington, you'd wonder if a lot of people are looking back at all of the other people who enabled this deal, this very light deal for what apparently was a serial sexual predator. I wonder if people are going to be looking at those people and all the people who allowed Epstein to sort of go on with his life for the last 15 years, including living in New York City and under conditions that other sex offenders might not have enjoyed.
Well, there was a Democratic believe district attorney in New York that when Epstein moved from Florida back to New York, he had to have a sex abuser charge or,
certain conditions that you live under if you've been designated a sex offender. And he was given a lighter classification. And
well, it was requested by a Democratic district attorney of a judge, and the judge was incredulous. So as you say, it's widespread. And then I just want to make sure we get this. There was investigative reporter Vicky Ward, who told NPR's Steve Inskeep this morning that in 2003, a mother and her two daughters told her that Epstein lured them to his house, abused them. She was writing a piece for Vanity Fair. Let's listen.
The piece was ready to go, and I had lots of people, including the artist Eric Fischel, who would vouchsafe for these two young women, vouchsafe for their characters, and corroborate, you know, their stories. When Jeffrey Epstein appeared in the magazine's offices, went to see the editor, and the next thing I knew was that these two women and their accounts and their mother's accounts had been cut out of the piece.
She says editor Graydon Carter cut them out of the piece. So as you said, lots of looking around now, Quill.
Yeah, and this also brings up questions the prosecutors have put out there about whether Epstein should be released on bail. The hearing for that has now been postponed until next week. But they're saying that not only is it flight risk because he owns private jets with the ability to fly internationally and because he has residences in several different countries, but also in the past he has worked to intimidate and silence witnesses against him. So they've said those are reasons that he should not be allowed bail.
Just briefly, what's the feeling there in Washington?
Well, certainly Democrats have been calling for Acosta's resignation, and some of them have been doing so since his confirmation. The president backed him up despite some press reports that he was not satisfied with Acosta's performance up till now.
Well, we'll follow this with NPR's Quill Lawrence. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Robin.
¥250 years ago today, Captain James Cook was on the first of his three great voyages to the Pacific Ocean. On this date, his crew was dismantling the camp they'd built to observe the transit of Venus from the island of Tahiti and setting off in search of a rumored continent called Terra Australis. We're going to continue our conversation now with Cliff Thornton, a member of the Captain Cook Society. I asked him how Cook traveled so far without the use of modern technology like sonar, a disadvantage that led Cook to almost sink his ship after he ran aground on the Great Barrier Reef.
Yes, yes. I think he was aware that as he was sailing north along the coast of the east coast of Australia, he was aware that there were reefs there. And sometimes they would anchor overnight, so there was no risk of running into them. But if there was too much depth to anchor, he went on at a slow speed. And it was in the middle of one night where he actually bumped into an isolated reef near Cooktown off Queensland.
Cooktown, named after him.
Yeah, wasn't there then, of course.
Right, yeah.
It was quite a bad leak, and the water was coming in, so he had to lighten the boat as quickly as he could. And the heaviest things on board were the cannon. And there were four cannon on the deck. He threw them overboard. He had a couple of cannon down below. He threw those overboard. He even took the iron ballast out and threw it overboard. Hmm. And you know, all those things were recovered 200 years later.
Wow.
They're scattered around the world. One's gone to the Philadelphia Museum. There's one in Sydney. There's one in the National Maritime Museum here in Greenwich.
Now, you mentioned Cooktown. He actually didn't name that many places after himself that he found, right?
Didn't name many. He didn't name any. Whenever possible, he would name a place using the name that he thought the locals gave it. Sometimes there were differences in spellings and pronunciations, but that was what he did. If it was a major feature, a mountain or something important like that, he would name it after a senior member of the government in the UK or a member of the gentry. Mm-hmm. And the bigger the geographical feature, the more important the person he would name it after.
What did he achieve from a navigation and mapping perspective? Because I understand that New Zealand was relying on Captain Cook's mapping of the islands until not that long ago.
You're right. 200 years. It's absolutely incredible that he could produce such a detailed map with what was called the running survey, which is sailing along, taking your bearings, using your angles, using your sextants and the plane table that he had on board and producing that map. And that map existed until we sent satellites up and we could get an accurate picture of New Zealand from space.
Now, he wasn't just looking in the South Pacific. He also went up to the Northwest Passage between modern-day Alaska and Russia. What was he trying to do there?
The aim was to improve trade with the Far East. And the only way of getting to the Far East in those days was to go either by the Cape of Good Hope around South Africa or via Cape Horn at the bottom of South America. And he took an enormous length of time to get to the Far East and to trade with China and India. The suggestion was that there may be a route to go over the north of Canada and come down through the Bering Strait, and that's what Cook was trying to do.
And he was not successful in doing that.
He got through the Bering Strait, but as he had encountered on his second voyage when he was in the Antarctic, you can only go so far before you hit a wall of ice and you couldn't progress any further.
And you're dealing with a wooden ship, right? Not an icebreaker.
Mm. That's correct.
So Cook's legacy today is complicated. How do people regard the places that he discovered for the British, the monuments to him? Some of them have been vandalized over the years.
Well, if you ask me what his legacy is, it would be a different story to if you asked an indigenous, let's say Maori or somebody from Hawaii. But as you are asking me, then I think that his legacy is the map of the Pacific. I remember there was a French explorer who was going to go out, and somebody said, well, what are you going to do? And he said, I don't know. Cook's done it all. There's nothing left for me to find, I don't think. A common thing that's in England today is tattooing has become very, very popular. It was Cook's voyages that brought tattooing back to the UK. Mm-hmm. The sailors were tattooed out in Tahiti and places around there and brought them back and said, hey, look what I've got. And now look what's happened. It's everywhere.
Well, tattooing, and the other word that sounds like tattoo also came from Cook's voyages, which is taboo.
Taboo, yeah. Which the priest or the king could put on an area and nobody would break that taboo. His legacy was also involved in curing scurvy. Have you heard of scurvy?
Yeah, well, scurvy, I didn't know much about scurvy before I learned about this, but basically it was a lack of vitamin C, and these sailors on these ships would go out there, and obviously you can't take oranges and lemons and limes for that many months at sea, so they wouldn't have anything.
Well, they didn't know what the cure was or what the cause was. They just knew that after 3 weeks after leaving shore, if you didn't have any fresh greens, etc., you would start to show these terrible signs of scurvy. And it is often pointed out that the great battles that were fought with the Royal Navy, more men died of scurvy than died during the battles. Hmm. It's that bad. Ships sailing, let's say the Dutch East India Company, sailing around to the East Indies, would way overcrew their ships simply because they knew a third of the men would die on the way with scurvy. So Cook's voyage on Endeavour, his first expedition, it was filled with all manner of suggested treatments to cure the scurvy. And he came back after 3 years at sea. He hadn't lost a man to scurvy. He'd lost them to various diseases that they contracted at Batavia. He'd lost one of the Marines overboard when he got drunk and jumped. But he hadn't lost a man to scurvy. And the Royal Society gave him a medal for that. The truth was, I don't think he knew what had actually stopped it. He had so many different remedies on board, one of the most famous being sauerkraut, pickled cabbage.
Mm-hmm.
The men weren't too keen on sauerkraut. So Cook told the ship's cook, dress some sauerkraut for me and put it on the officer's table every day and say, this is for officers only. And it was a little bit of psychology, and it worked, because the men said, hey, we want that. And they ate it, and maybe that kept the scurvy away.
Let's talk about how Captain Cook died. He died in Hawaii. He was killed in Hawaii. What happened?
Mm. Well, it's a long, sad story. He had a successful visit to Hawaii, and he set off to continue north to the Bering Strait again, but the ship sprung a mast, and he had to return. He came back to Kealakekua Bay, which was where he'd been before. It said that he'd come back at a different series when a different god was in favour. Okay, he could live with that. But he didn't like them stealing one of the ship's cutters. So he invited a local chief to come on board, and the chief was walking along the coast to get on his boat. And the people said, don't go, chief, don't go. And the chief sat down. And people came from the other side of the bay and said, look, bad things are happening. Don't go with this man. They formed up along the beach, and suddenly a hail of stones came over from the people, and Cook fired one of the barrels. He had a double-barrel blunderbuss type thing. Mm-hmm. It had small shot in. It didn't have anything. The small shot just bounced
just
off the cape.
A little bit.
Bounced off the cape. This man thought, hey, he's shot, and I'm not being killed. And it just emboldened them, and I'm afraid they attacked the shore party. The Marines fired, but you know how long it takes to reload one of those long muskets. they were all over them, and they just ran for their lives to the boats. And of course, Cook, he was left on the beach and he was attacked and he was drowned there. Yeah.
So the reason that we are talking about this right now is because the author, Tony Horowitz, just recently passed away suddenly. And he had written this incredible book with your help about Captain Cook. You're one of the subjects in the book.
Oh, I just have a walk on roll.
Walk on roll. Well, you're in there for at least 100 pages. But anyway, he went and retraced the steps of Captain Cook.
Yes, he certainly did.
Well, let's just talk about Tony Horowitz for a minute. What was it like to work with him?
It was an honor and a privilege, and I didn't realize it at the time. But that man was I would call him a literary alchemist. He took what I thought were ordinary events of the day, things that were made of lead. But when you read about them in his book, he turned them into burnished gold. I'm thinking, well, I was there, I saw that, but I never saw it through the eyes that Tony had, to make it so readable. I once had the privilege of having a peek in his study, and the bookcase was absolutely full of the best, the most academic books about Cook. That man's had such a knowledge about Cook.
Well, and I would recommend that any of our listeners go and read this book, Blue Latitudes, Boldly Going Where Captain Cook Has Gone Before, because it is really fascinating. Cliff Thornton, let me just ask you finally, what made you so interested in Captain Cook in the first place?
Well, I was born and bred in a little place called Stockton-on-Tees, which is a couple of miles from the little village of Marton where Cook was born. And I guess as a teenager, I didn't really appreciate him. And it was not till I returned to Middlesbrough following my career in museums that I just happened to be there when the town was celebrating the 250th anniversary of Cook's birth. The town took the bold decision to build a brand new museum about Captain Cook. And Cook's been with me ever since.
That is Cliff Thornton, who is a member of the Captain Cook Society. Thank you so much for joining us and remembering Captain Cook.
A real pleasure, John. Thank you.
And you can listen to our full conversation at hereandnow.org, where we've also got a map of Captain Cook's voyages.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Emberwave, the revolutionary new personal thermostat that's designed to help you find thermal wellness in any situation. Emberwave can put you in control of your comfort in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, in restaurants or theaters, after a workout, at home, and more. Learn more at emberwave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. Emberwave, own your temperature.
Democrat and billionaire Tom Steyer says he is running for president after insisting months ago that he would not. That means the count of Democrats running is still 24 because Congressman Eric Swalwell just dropped out. For the latest, let's bring in NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro. Hi, Domenico.
Hey, Jeremy.
So we know Steyer from those ads that are airing all the time about impeaching President Trump.
Right.
But he didn't mention that today. Instead, he focused on income inequality. Let's listen to this campaign ad he released today.
We have a society that's very unequal, and it's really important for people to understand that this society is connected. If this is a banana republic with a few very, very rich people and everybody else living in misery, that's a failure.
What about that message, Domenico, or how does he fit into this field?
Well, I know I'm supposed to have the answers here, but my question is, what's changed? You know, in January, Tom Steyer said he wasn't going to run. He was going to focus on pouring in tens of millions of dollars into this impeachment message. And now he's suddenly had a change of heart and decides to run. And there's not a single mention in the 4-minute announcement video of the word impeach. It does not come up in his entire video. So, look, he's going to run. He's got this outsider message. He's a billionaire who said that he has given – he's, you know, one of these people who's taken this billionaire pledge to give away half of his wealth. So we'll see if he can make a dent. The problem is for him, just like it was for Eric Swalwell and is for a whole host of these other candidates, we keep hearing from people on the campaign trail, for as egalitarian as these Democratic voters are, as much as they want little d democracy, they think there are too many candidates.
Okay, well, let's talk about one of the candidates who had a very good fundraising haul. Elizabeth Warren announced that she had raised $19 million in the past 3 months. That's a lot more than she had in previous quarters and more than her progressive rival Bernie Sanders. What do you think about that?
Well, it's a big deal. I mean, the fact that she raised $19.1 million, an average donation of $28, which, you know, only a dollar more than Bernie Sanders' $27 that he's so often touted over the last two presidential cycles. And really what it shows, and what people close to Sanders have told me, is that they're worried about splitting the progressive vote with Elizabeth Warren. They say that they're not going to attack her because they see her as one of the good guys in this fight to sort of change the country to be more progressive rather than just pick somebody who can, quote, beat Trump, for whatever that means. And they said unless they're the last two standing, they're not really going to draw contrasts with Elizabeth Warren, which they're concerned about because each of these states, so many of these states have 15% thresholds to be able to have your delegates count, that if they split the progressive vote, then that could be a real problem. They also said because she's a woman, so many Democratic voters want to elect more women that they're afraid that they'll pick Elizabeth Warren over Bernie Sanders.
Domenico, finally, I want to get your thoughts on a former presidential candidate who has died, Ross Perot. Just remind us of the impact he had on our politics and whether, you know, even whether Bill Clinton would have gotten elected if it hadn't been for Ross Perot back in the 92 election, getting so much support in that race.
Well, there's huge debate about whether or not Ross Perot's almost 20% of the vote helped get Bill Clinton elected or not. A lot of statisticians will go through that and say that's a myth. The fact is he made a huge impact because of his message and his personality. And, you know, for the hunger that supposedly there is today for an independent candidate, we haven't seen somebody quite like Ross Perot come back to the scene. And he really was indicative of how difficult it is to break the two-party system.
NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro, thank you.
You're so welcome.
It's here and now, and that's what corporations are saying about climate change. 215 of the biggest global companies report almost $1 trillion is at risk from climate impacts, those likely to hit within 5 years or happening now. For example, PG&E filed for bankruptcy protection after facing billions in liabilities for its role in those deadly fires in California. In the past, corporations have covered up the impact of climate change. Exxon comes to mind. But now investors are telling them they want transparency. We want to take an occasional look at corporations and climate change, starting today with a nonprofit that helps them disclose risks and helps investors understand them. Bruno Sarda is president of CDP North America. Bruno, you say companies are taking climate change much more seriously now.
You know, it's been evolving. So not only are they taking this seriously, but we're definitely seeing a sophistication in how they are caring, especially since last year, a great interest in, regardless of how these companies are impacting the environment and causing climate change, what will a changing climate cause their businesses, and also incorporating their supply chains. So to look at kind of their, if you will, their supply risk. And clearly the numbers are big and they're just the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah. Well, so for instance, you have BASF, that's the German chemical company, saying, acknowledging that they have a significant corporate carbon footprint. They don't want to scare off environmentally conscious shareholders. They acknowledge that as a problem for them. You have Hitachi, the Japanese manufacturer, worried about increased rainfall and flooding in Southeast Asia, knocking out suppliers there and saying that they have to take defensive measures. So is this the kind of transparency that investors are looking for?
Yes, absolutely. They really want these organizations to get pretty granular in terms of not just, you know, we have a big carbon footprint, but through the CDP disclosure, it's saying where, it's saying, you know, what are their means of production? What is the carbon intensity of their various operations, both at a operational and functional level, but also geographically. So where are these intensities? You know, how could they be affected, for example, by changing regulation, for example, for price on carbon? And actually, many organizations are acknowledging that even a modest price on carbon could significantly affect their financial performance if they are very carbon intensive currently.
Right. And this is, you know, being taxed for their carbon output or being forced to pay, you know, for how much they produce. You also hear from banks that if they loan in areas where there's going to be terrible flooding, they're acknowledging, gee, these loans might not be paid back. I mean, get down to that granular level. Some of the things that corporations are acknowledging could be climate-related problems for them and their investors down the road.
There are two broad risk categories. Some are called physical risks and some are called transition risks. Physical risks might be like if you're Coca-Cola and you have a bottling plant on the side of a river where you need to pull a lot of water, and maybe that water is not expected to be there within 5 or 10 years. That water, that river might run dry. Or on the contrary, if you have a plant like maybe a power plant or something else also on the side of a river, and it's expected to keep flooding because of the increase in extreme weather. These are physical risks that have, you know, a very real cost that will affect financial performance. And then transition risks could be anything from new regulation that countries or states might put in place to try to regulate the externality that is, let's say, carbon pollution into the atmosphere. It could also be things like the disruption of new technologies that are coming as a result of the huge demand, for example, for renewable energy from corporate America, or other examples where your core business could be disrupted by a transition to a lower carbon economy, for example.
Yeah. What do you do about the fact that corporations, or people within them, lie? They don't tell the truth, or they don't, you maybe understand, we mentioned PG&E, the California Power Company. When they filled out your report last year, they estimated the potential financial impact from wildfires around $2.5 billion. Turns out they were wrong by about $28 billion, you know, in their fire liabilities. As we've said, they've gone bankrupt. Then you have Exxon. According to that blockbuster reporting in Scientific American, they knew about climate change about 40 years ago, not only well knew about it, but actively paid others to put out disinformation about climate change. I mean, it just really makes you angry when you hear about this. Why should people trust the reporting these companies make to you?
You know, that's at the end of the day, that's the heart of CDP's mission. You know, what we do is we create transparency and we expose, if you will, what these companies have to say about these topics. And then both through our own analysis and insights, as well as what these investors and financial companies do, they can then assess whether, frankly, whether they believe it, just like any other information that an organization might report on their sales projections or anything else. Investors will have to decide whether they believe this information is credible.
Right. Right.
And then they can determine whether they want to own a particular company, whether they want to lend them money, whether they want to insure them, et cetera.
It's one thing to kind of estimate through computer models what cost from an increase in taxes on carbon might be. It's another to, you know, try to think broadly about, as you say, the supply chain and all these other things that you might encounter. But do you have private conversations with people from these companies? I mean, have you found yourself in a room with somebody who's resistant to this? And if so, what do you say to them?
Sure, sure. You know, and actually before I joined CDP, I spent nearly 10 years actually on the other side of that conversation, leading and you know, overseeing the disclosures to CDP for many years at Dell in the IT sector, and then later on for an energy company. So I've actually had both sides of that conversation.
Well, what do you say? What do you say to someone who's resistant, to someone who says, that's crazy? I'm not going to tell everybody, you know, what my concerns are about my losses. I mean, what do you say to somebody to encourage them if they're not yet on this train?
I think, you know, here in 2019, looking at over 7,000 of the world's largest companies are disclosing, you know, 525 of the world's largest investors have made it clear that they want this information. Any executive who says, I don't want to do it, the first question you really want to ask them is, what are you hiding? Disclosing this information willingly to your investors and your lenders and your customers, that signals something in and of itself. It is no longer a reasonable choice not to be transparent about this.
Should there be more pressure? You found that countries in the, or headquartered at least in the EU, much more likely to give you these detailed effects of global warming because local regulations require them to. The U.S., China, Brazil, Mexico, less likely. The Securities and Exchange Commission in the U.S. doesn't mandate publicly traded companies acknowledge potential climate impacts. But should there be a mandate?
I mean, for sure, CDP is very much on record saying that, you know, these are absolutely financially material data. We firmly believe it should be required. But at the same time, as long as it's not, it is absolutely financially material. And we will continue to work with investors to help them make decisions as to whether or not they want to continue deploying capital into organizations that are not taking this seriously and that are not being transparent about it.
Is this made tougher now because of this administration, the Trump administration, which has rolled back environmental protections and rolled back the fight against climate change? Does that make it harder? Or are you hearing from the business community, we are not waiting for them?
So, you know, I mean, for sure, you know, what's happening right now in the federal government is certainly not what we would hope for. I mean, the science is clear. The facts are here. This is not a matter of opinion. And this, you know, this kind of obfuscation and denial is unproductive. And frankly, it's bad management for this country. Having said that, actually, to your point, because of this, you know, irresponsible abdication of authority and responsibility at the federal level, we have seen investors and companies step up. You have, you know, over 2,500 companies have signed something called the We Are Still In Declaration, who were very clear that they are still committed to the goals of the Paris Climate Agreement. And so there are all kinds of, you know, if you will, shimmers of light and great stories of proactive action and leadership in all kinds of areas from companies and investors, in large part because of government inaction, certainly in the United States.
Bruno Cerda, president of CDP North America. Bruno, thanks so much.
Thank you.
By the way, Bruno says a leader in this field is Walmart because of its work to reduce supply chain greenhouse gas emissions. We'll continue to take a look at corporations and climate change.
We all know we should be off our phones when driving. It is dangerous and not worth it. Yet research shows that 9 out of 10 drivers admit to using their phones while driving anyway. Steph Yin of WHYY's The Pulse takes a look at why it's so difficult to stop.
I'm not proud of it, but I'm on my phone pretty often when I'm driving. I toggle between podcasts, music, and audiobooks. I surf social media, make calls. I've even written emails. I know the facts, like every day, 9 people in the U.S. are killed and more than 1,000 are injured in crashes involving distracted driving. So why am I making such bad choices? To find out, I talked to Kit Delgado, an emergency physician and professor at the University of Pennsylvania. He's interested in what's called behavioral economics, the factors that go into flawed decision-making. He says there's present bias, meaning we give more weight to benefits in the present moment.
People tend to respond to immediate gratification rather than delaying things so that, you know, to prevent crashes in the future.
Then there's overconfidence bias.
If you ask a room of 100 drivers, you know, how they compare to other drivers in terms of their driving safety, 90% will say that they're safer than other drivers.
And recency bias.
You've just completed hundreds of trips without getting into a crash. You probably used your phone for some of them. So when that phone ping goes off, you're not even calculating that risk of getting into a crash because you've never experienced it before.
There are lots of efforts to get us to not use our phones when driving. High schools now run programs on the issue. There are media campaigns to shift cultural attitudes.
No text is worth the risk. It can wait.
Currently, 48 states ban texting and driving. Delgado is working on the technology side with an app company called TrueMotion that tracks driving behaviors like texting and other distractions. Their idea is to pair good driving with incentives, like discounts on insurance. I decided to try one of TrueMotion's apps, driving and using my phone as I normally would. But after 2 weeks using their family app, I got an A+, a perfect score for avoiding distraction. How is that possible? I hopped on a call with TrueMotion.
I'm Rafi Feingold, and I'm VP of Loyalty and Behavior here at TrueMotion.
Feingold showed me that TrueMotion did, in fact, register my phone use, but they didn't count it because they considered it passive use. I was tapping and swiping my phone, but in a mount, not in my hand.
We didn't want to ding people for behaviors that they considered to be safe. Having your phone in a mount is probably safer than interacting with your phone in the hand.
Still, Feingold told me that I drove about 13 hours and used my phone in the mount almost 30% of the time. That percentage was concerning to me. If you asked me to give myself a grade, I'd probably give myself a C. I felt distracted. Feingold says TrueMotion's planning to come out with a mounted tap detection feature this year, which should account for some of my concerns. But to be real, my concern goes beyond how well an app can track my driving. What truly worries me is that my impulse to use my phone while driving is really strong, even though I'm aware of the potential consequences.
The worst offenders, the drivers that are distracted on their phone almost 30% of the time, we call these folks phone addicts.
That's Jonathan Matthews, the CEO of Zendrive, a company that studies driving behavior through data and analytics. In April, Zendrive published their yearly report, based on more than 160 billion miles of driver data. It found that one in every 12 drivers is a phone addict.
This is our generation's drunk driving. We are conditioned to have these devices next to us, 6 feet or less throughout the day, and we become dependent on them.
Matthew says smartphones are hacking into reward systems in our brains, affecting dopamine and serotonin, the same pathways triggered by other addictive things like slot machines and cocaine. He says one of the best things you can do for reducing phone use while driving is to practice leaving your phone behind in daily life.
Put the phone in the fridge, and go out for a stroll around the block, and talk to our neighbors, and talk to some strangers, cook a meal, enjoy the weather.
We can also rewire our circuits by reframing what makes us feel good. Make it a goal to drive without using your phone, and reward yourself if you succeed. Here's one super easy thing to help. iPhones have a setting called Do Not Disturb While Driving. Androids have a similar mode. The setting prevents calls and messages from coming in unless the sender says it's an emergency. It'll send an auto reply to anyone who tries to contact you, so you don't have to worry about leaving people hanging. Here's Delgado's.
I wrote here, boo, I'm right behind you. No, just kidding. I'm driving with Do Not Disturb. While driving turned on, I'll see your message when I get where I'm going.
He thinks if this setting comes as the default on new phones, it will simply become a new social norm. I'm trying it out myself. I'll let you know if it works. For Here and Now, I'm Steph Yin.
If you're driving right now, put the phone down. Here and Now is plenty of entertainment. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.